want to continue your train of thought or answer the question?
No, I was complete. Okay. I completed that particular.
Okay. Was this the first time you had met the Shah?
Yes, indeed.
What were your impressions of the Shah? What were your impressions of the Shah?
My impressions of the Shah at the time was a man of a high degree of apparent self-assurance, underscore the apparent. As I mentioned a moment ago, he tended to be unchecked within his own country and therefore to expect agreement. But knowing something of his history as a younger man, I was concerned with the apparentness, as it were, of the self-assurance. He did not strike me as an immensely tenacious person, as opposed to one who was used to getting his own way and had the appearance, therefore, of self-confidence for that reason. He had not been proved, as it were, under adversity. Much had been handed to him. In addition to that, I was reasonably impressed with his articulateness, with his general intelligence, with his ability to formulate and express his views. Some of those views tended to get a little far-fetched. He had developed some grandiose notions about the future of Iran, much of which were captured by Miss Falachi, or whatever her name was, in the interview, in which he was going to catch up and surpass West Germany and France in a decade's time, or something like that. That's the fanciful part of the Shah. And he tends to be carried away on these flights of fancy. Unfortunately, there was nobody inside of his country that could really say, Your Majesty, you better think that one over again. They tended to be yes men, and he tended to select people who were yes men. That became increasingly clear. One was impressed, as I recall it, with his role as absolute monarch. It tended to be so different from the comportment of senior officials in a democratic society who, however overwhelmed they are with their own importance or self-confidence, tends to be much more reasoned in expressing themselves.
Hughes in Washington, did you have meetings with him?
Yes, he came to the Pentagon.
Yeah. You discussed the arms sales issues, you mentioned that.
We discussed that. Generally speaking, it was an exposition. He was primarily concerned with expressing his strategic judgments, and I was eager to express my concern about the possible wastage of resources. It was under those circumstances that I suggested that he put together a staff so that he could monitor the balance of expenditures so that his armed forces were capable of fighting rather than merely acquiring weaponry. To which, as I recall, he agreed. I don't agree that he did more than acquiesce, but I'm not sure that he embraced the notion in its entirety on the spot.
I've been doing these meetings in July. There were discussions of petroleum policy with the Shah. Did you participate in those talks?
I do not recall so doing. As you'll recall, this was some months before the Arab oil embargo, before the Yom Kippur War. I know that there were those discussions. The Shah did mention to me his desire to sell directly to the United States and to have, in effect, a guaranteed market here so that he could move more oil, so he could get more returns and thereby play an even better role in terms of stabilizing the Gulf. But it was a very brief set of comments. It was during, he pressed that quite hard with Secretary Kissinger, and I'm certain he pressed it with Nixon as well.
So I thought you were getting assurances about the stability of supply. Is that what he was doing in a way?
He was making such assurances, but he was talking more about the mutual advantages in terms of trade, as it were. That he was a reliable friend of the United States. There was not an insinuation, I don't think, that the Saudis might cut us off just 4 months later, or 3 months later. He offered to provide all the oil, at one point or another during this period, to provide all the oil that the United States might want at some guaranteed price, which was above the market price, as I recall. Kissinger has repeatedly joked in subsequent years that he, Kissinger, was such a good businessman that when the Shah offered him a guaranteed supply of oil at $5 a barrel, that he turned him down. This was by the time the price of oil had gotten to $35 a barrel. That was Kissinger's humor, because obviously if the market had changed, the Shah was not going to buy by any $5 guaranteed price. But that Kissinger's jokes about these matters, I think, reflect the nature of the conversations with the Shah. As needless to say, it was not regarded as appropriate for the United States government to enter into a commercial relationship with the Shah, and that the decision of where to lift oil was going to be left to the marketplace, to the major oil importing companies. That is not necessarily what the Shah wanted to hear, because he had had enough experience with those companies and he didn't think that they were in existence to serve his purposes. He was quite right about that.
At these meetings, were there any decisions made about arms sales, if you recall? Was it more done in general terms? Did any decisions come out of the meetings?
No. In fact, the principal issue was the F-14 and the F-15. The Shah indicated he wanted both of them. I urged him not to establish two complicated logistical trains for two separate weapon systems, that he choose between the two. And I think I said that if it were my choice, that I would choose the F-15. Shah was pretty well committed to the F-13. Turned out he started to order the F-14 thereafter. He never did get around, whether persuaded by my comments or not, to order the F-15, which he had originally intended to do, for which I got into considerable hot water with the Missouri delegation. And Senator Symington chided me, or more than chided me, during my appearances before the Armed Services Committee. I took the simple view from the first that it was that arms sales were not intended to fatten up the U.S. balance of payments, that they were not intended to satisfy the military services by achieving lower unit costs or the activities of particular firms in particular states or districts. That was not a universally popular view. I think that it was a sensible view in general, but it was particularly sensible given the climate of the time and the widespread view in public opinion that we ought not to be fostering either arms races or arms sales merely for the commercial motives.
Well, I had a sense that the Navy Air Force Procurement Bureaus were keenly interested in selling.
Absolutely, that's what I just hinted at when I said the desire of the services to lower per unit costs. I dealt with that, as a matter of fact. I think I dealt with it. I certainly dealt with it conceptually by telling the services that they were not going to benefit by arms sales in terms of their budgetary outcomes, that to the extent that they successfully sold a package to a country, that I was going to reduce the aggregate for that service by the reduction in the cost of that weapon system to the service. I wanted to remove the incentive to the individual services to go around the world hawking arms. And I think that I certainly weakened that incentive as an economic incentive. There's a good deal of service pride and the tendency amongst the services were to push their weapon systems for reasons beyond economic. But I hope to pull away the budgetary incentives. And I gave instructions early on that there was to be no deliberate hawking of weapon systems, of the whetting of appetites of potentially recipient countries, that we as a country should neither sell weapons simply for balance of payments reasons, nor should we sell weapons unless there was a good military reason. Now, from time to time, we would have to respond to the desires of potential recipients, but we should not be there whetting their appetites. I think that that position of mine may have had some influence, but basically the services continued in the game of whetting appetites.
It's very difficult to control, I would imagine.
Well, it's very difficult to control. I think that I did much of what one can do simply by taking away the budgetary incentive, and to the extent that I told the Navy directly that they were not going to benefit in a budgetary sense from the sale of the F-14. And I also told them that they were to sell the weapon system at a price that redeemed some of the R&D costs that had gone into the weapon system. The Navy in that case, but the services generally would fight that off because it raised the price and therefore diminished the prospect of sales. They were interested very much in reducing the out-of-pocket cost. They weren't worried in past history like R&D.
According to a report issued in 1976 by the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, the report on arms sales in Iran, it suggested that the various armed services procurement bureaus were in such intense competition for selling weapons in league with the contractors that there was a state of near anarchy within the Pentagon in terms of effective control over arms sales.
I don't know where they got that. I don't think that there was anarchy. That was the kind of thing that was being pumped up at the time by critics on Capitol Hill who, as I indicated a few moments ago, were quite concerned about arms sales in general and the arms race. And any sales by the United States, that kind of assertion about anarchy in the Pentagon, I think was just wholly wrong. Now, what is true, of course, is that there was a great deal of competition within the Pentagon, and that to some extent that was accepted. It certainly had been encouraged by previous secretaries of defense. As you remember, Secretary McNamara had told Kennedy that he was going to solve the American balance of payments problems insofar as the defense budget was concerned by foreign sales. And when he decided that, he's a man of great determination. So the history was of eagerness to push sales. I was opposed to that for policy reasons, as I indicated. The fact that I weakened incentives did not necessarily curb the habit, but it certainly weakened the habit. And to the extent that the competition in arms sales continued, it continued more covertly than it previously did.
Is it possible that Nixon and Kissinger had balance of payments considerations in mind when they made the large decision in May 72?
I don't think so. I don't know whether this is a compliment to the two gentlemen or a criticism, but Kissinger never worried 20 seconds about that kind of low commercial motive. And while Nixon might have, I don't think it was a major one. It became a motive later on, after the Yom Kippur War and the explosion of oil prices and the immense surpluses that the Shah began to pull in. At that point, we were seriously worried about our balance of payments position and the notion of getting back the monies we were paying out for oil by weapon sales became, I think, more powerful. It became an increased motive. There was also, in a sense, a motive for me when I made the decision that we were going to reclaim part of the research and development costs and charge the Shah and others full cost for these weapons over the protests of the services who wanted to maximize sales by avoiding full cost pricing, since they were. Such sales did not go to the service. They were an indirect beneficiary of such sales. And that my notion of full cost pricing was based in part upon the explosion of balance of payment surpluses by the oil producers of the Middle East. So it was not a consideration that was irrelevant as far as I was concerned.
You would force this policy?
What?
You enforced this policy of course.
Well, while I was there, indeed, we loaded in research and development costs and full average cost pricing. What happened to it after I left, I don't know.
I have some questions about the price explosion in oil and OPEC prices. Well, this happened in the fall, late fall of 73, early winter.
That's right.
Did you take part in the Nixon administration's discussions of policy responses to this action? I was just talking about a minute ago about the
policy. I was only marginally involved in that.
Moving on, Bill, in early 75.
The policy, insofar as it was defense responses in the event of, during the period of the oil shortage or subsequently prospective oil shortages, what defense policy should be and how oil should be allocated, of course, and those things, I was fully engaged. But beyond that area, no.
In early 75, in the midst of the recession, Henry Kissinger suggested the possibility of military action against the oil producers as they kept on raising prices and economically strangled the West, as he put it.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
did
Kissinger discuss this with you before he set up his
You mean those particular words? No, he didn't discuss it with me, as I recall it, those particular words, but I was not unsympathetic to the point of view that he expressed. I thought that he expressed it rather boldly, and of course there came the issue came up immediately. He talked to me before a press conference that I gave in the wake of his, I think it was Business Week article, and he said, yeah, I want you to climb in behind me and support what I said, which I certainly was prepared to do. The questions came up about what the Department of Defense could do to deal with the stranglehold, and we indicated that while we were not planning to do anything, that we certainly had the capability, so on. So there was, I think, some consideration given to contingency plans for the movement into the Gulf if need arose, and indeed one could not respond to those kinds of things without taking out the contingency plans and looking at them. When I gave my press conference subsequently, I made certain statements about the United States being, while not wishing to act, that if the President called upon us to act, that the Department was prepared to act and so forth, which was widely interpreted in the Persian Gulf as a threat. And so much of the criticism that had been directed towards Kissinger got deflected towards me, an outcome that he may have welcomed.
But beyond the task, the contingency planning, was there a serious discussion of this as an option internally, in the NSC level or otherwise?
There was some discussion of it, yes. The fact of the matter was that it was widely viewed, it was a very revolutionary development, as it were, and that it was upsetting the established routine. The failure of the United States to crack the whip meant that the whip hand on such matters was passing away from the United States, and there was some discussion of the possibility of a seizure of one of the countries in the Gulf, one of the lesser countries, but there was, by and large, idle talk. No one was really serious about that, but I think it was more of an expression of frustration.
Now, after the oil price increases, there's an explosion or expansion of Iranian arms purchases.
Right.
They could afford it. There's a qualitative increase.
Not only could afford the things, but they could afford to pay full-cost pricing, as I indicated a moment ago, and would.
Now, in the light of the concerns that you already had about arms sales to Iran and the implications for social and economic development, did this increasingly concern you? Did this concern you even more about the impact of
Iran? Yes. Not increasingly. It represented a continuation, perhaps of some degree of reinforcement of what had been a nagging worry. But I had the Shah, I hope, convinced that he needed to keep in mind the balance between civilian and military side and the balance within military expenditures so that his armed forces could fight. It was a continuing problem because of the weaknesses in country. I became increasingly concerned about something else, however, something that later became more important. Obviously important later on, and that was the way that the Iranians and the American supplies were dealing with the lack of technical capability in country was to move more and more Americans into the country, contractor representatives and the like, who could service this equipment. My concern about that was quite simple. That the more Americans that you had in country living quite well, and and, as it were, taking care of the military establishment to the extent that you did not have elements of the public sharing in the improvements in living conditions, those Americans would become the object of resentment. I wanted very much to hold down the number of Americans and tech reps and that sort of thing in the country. And therefore, the fact that the Shah could afford more was not necessarily a good thing from the standpoint of increase in hostility in the United States. I should emphasize, however, even though we were aware of, or I was aware of that general problem, none of us, I think, were aware of the degree to which hostility to the Americans would rise. None of us would have anticipated at that time the developments of 78, 79. But the general proposition that the more Americans you have living in the country, living high on the hog, the greater potential for anger was understood by me, and I hope by others. Now, there's one other aspect that I should mention, and that is that the explosion of resources that the Shah had meant that he could afford to increase living standards within the country, not necessarily by providing complex equipments, but by food supplies, the basic necessities of life. He should have done that. Indeed, one of the differences between the great success that the Saudis have had in precluding populist passions as where oil revenues rose, and the Shah, was that the Saudis were very attentive to the Bedouin, to the man in the street, and saw to it that the benefits of that increased flow of revenue to the kingdom resulted in improved standard of living. The Shah, even though in his early years he had been a social reformer, as in the White Revolution, became quite indifferent to that, and allowed so much of the revenue to be diverted away from the masses that there was this growing resentment. In retrospect, it's plain that what could have been helpful to the Shah became a liability in terms of controlling the country.
Did you get a sense of what accounted for that greater indifference to
Well, as I said, this was an autocrat. Increasingly with the passage of years, he knew best what was good for his country, and it cut off commentary from below. He had another problem. He was too bright. He was probably one of the best minds in the world. As I say, unchecked by contact and falling with other minds, capable of. So he tended to build these castles in the sky, and nobody bothered. Nobody could break in to tell him there's a kind of great deal of restlessness out there. And of course, to the extent that restlessness came up, it could always be presented to him as the work of agitators, Soviet-influenced people, and that sort of thing, some of which was true, but there's a lot there to feed on.
You mentioned a minute ago about your concern about the growing number of American technicians in Iran. Did you have the capacity to control the inputs, or was that something beyond your control, basically?
I could not control it. I could influence it to some extent and hope to influence it to more extent, but that was driven by the Shah, and while I could have in principle laid the wood to the contractors I don't think that the expenditure of political capital would have worked it, even if the outcome were better. But with the shortage of trained people in the country, it was not obvious to me that denying American personnel in Iran would be beneficial on balance, because it would mean that these weapon systems wouldn't work and even more of the available Iranians would be their care and maintenance.
I'm glad that members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff became concerned after 73 the expansion of arms sales to Iran would have a negative impact on the readiness of the U.S. military. Is this a concern that came to your attention? This is mentioned in the Senate report also.
No, I think that that's one of those things that people think of in retrospect. What was true is that there was
this is in 76 that they're saying this.
I understand.
In the midst of it.
Yeah. I understand.
Yeah.
What was true was that in 70, after 73, that the rapid drawdown of U.S. inventories for the benefit of the Israelis created a good deal of problems within the military establishment. But the purchases by Iran were much more measured, so that while there's always concern it was very modest. And you must bear in mind that the services themselves were making up the delivery schedules, and the services, as we referred to a few moments ago, were very active in promoting sales to the extent that one stated later on that these dreadful sales might interfere with the delivery of equipment to our own units. That tends to be just a trifle hypocritical. I did not notice the Air Force, for example, saying a serious impact on the availability of F-15s leads us to conclude that it's best for the Navy to deliver F-14s to Iran, or the Navy saying it's too much for us, let the Air Force handle this one. No, that's the kind of, there's a smidgen of truth in that, but only a smidgen, and it certainly didn't bother the military establishment by and large.
Now, through the arms sales program, there were numbers of instances where we reported that U.S. weapon sales and paid off Iranian officials to expedite and cement deals. Did we talk about this come to your attention very early in the game?
Yeah, so I think I talked to the Shah about that. And I got the standard answer from that there was no corruption inside of the country. Which he himself just might have believed. It was against our policies. Policies of the Department of Defense. We leaned against that as much as we could possibly do in the abstract. And in the concrete, if we caught somebody, we would have punished them. But once again, in retrospect, at least, I think you're attempting to control something that can't be controlled, sort of like controlling the drug trade by talking to Colombian officials. When you have that demand, as you have in the United States, the supply will be forthcoming. When you have the demand in Iran, it's very hard to control by actions taken by this government.
Nelson argued that Kissinger, the State Department, passively discouraged or suppress criticisms of the arms sales problems out of fear that might lead to that it might jeopardize congressional support for the program itself.
Well, I think that's
is that exaggerated or
No, I think that's perfectly true. I don't see anything exceptional about that. The United States government had a policy of supporting the Shah. Kissinger was thoroughly committed not only to the policy, but to the rationale for the policy. They certainly don't like to see a lot of criticism that might affect or undermine the policy. I don't see anything exceptional about that. I think that within the administration that there was some tendency for the senior people at state to be blind to real problems, balance, problems of balance, basically, because they were so committed to the policy. I think that that's a more serious matter, though perhaps not a more novel matter, than that they didn't want a lot of criticism that would interfere with congressional support. I've never noticed any administration that was eager to have criticism that spilled over into a loss of congressional support for the policies that the administration had embraced. And let's just take that as a given.
I know that in late 73, you met with the Shah, I guess in Iran, to discuss some of the implications of buying high-tech U.S. weapons.
I didn't go to Iran. I think that I can't remember. My recollection is of two trips that the Shah made to the United States, one in 73 and the other maybe in the spring of 75. In the spring of 75, I wound up being his official host for part of his trip and took him to his aircraft and so forth, because the president and Kissinger were out of town at the close of the trip, and I was the most senior visitor, the official president. But my recollection is that it was only on that two occasions that I visited with the Shah. I did not go to Iran.
In between those 2 years?
I did not go to Iran at all. Well, that brings you down to 1978, when I thought of going to Iran during the collapse, but no, I did not go to Iran. I have not been to Iran since the Ayatollah took over.
Okay.
I had many opportunities, needless to say. The Shah was quite eager to have American defense secretaries visiting his country.
Now, apparently during 73 or early 74, I'm not sure about the chronology, you appointed Richard Halleck as a representative in Iran.
Well, I don't remember the precise details. As you know, Halleck had been at the Rand Corporation. I discovered that he was working for the Bureau of the Budget when I arrived at the Bureau of the Budget. If recollection serves me, I brought him over from the Bureau of the Budget to the Department of Defense sometime after I became Defense Secretary. Halleck had worked quite closely with the Turkish General Staff on these very problems that I've been describing to you. The problem of making sure that a force structure can fight, as well as merely having been equipped without the appropriate balance between sustaining capabilities, logistics, force structure, trained manpower, and so forth. One of the problems that you have with the underdeveloped countries, in fact, the developed countries, is that the hunger for hardware gets to be so compelling that they don't bother with all of the complementary capabilities that they need. And when I offered to provide to the Shah on that first trip, when I urged the Shah to have in mind a group that would study these things, I offered to provide some personnel. I don't remember that the Shah accepted on the spot, as I indicated earlier. He sort of acquiesced in the general concept, and then either then or later indicated he would like to have some support. I sent Halleck out, presumably to do the same kind of mission that he had done Turkish general, working with the Turkish general staff. And the basic purpose of that was to preclude the weapons sellers from inundating the country. That purpose became all the more pressing after the oil embargo, because there was so much cash sloshing around that the eagerness to acquire some of that cash became overwhelming.
Did you sort of monitor Halleck's efforts while he was there?
I monitored them in part. He would drop back every once in a while. I don't remember when we sent him out there. It must have been 74. When he came back, he would drop in and see me, but I think that I didn't have all the time to deal with one country. One that that was not central to my interests. My interests tended to center on NATO, which was my principal problem as far as I was concerned. These other countries, I regarded it as a much less critical importance. I turned it over generally to Martin Hoffman, who was for some time the special assistant and general counsel of the department, and had been with me at the Atomic Energy Commission, so he followed that much more closely. Halleck did a great deal of complaining about the greedy and people from industry who were trying to acquire some of the Shah's wealth, the country's wealth, so that the later developments in his career, giving all of his preachments on the subject, simply astonished me when they came to light.
Which were?
They came to my attention when
what's that? Oh, was this glad he was in Iran?
It came to my attention when I was Secretary of Energy, it turned out. I don't remember the details precisely. You can find out from the Department of Defense, I presume, that he had signed a contract with the Shah and had gone on the Shah's payroll, which was quite explicitly prohibited. He had signed a contract for a firm that he was on. So, in view of all of his preachments on the subject, I found that stunning.
This is when he was working for you at DOD. He was in Iran.
No,
in Iran.
Well,
working for DOD.
He was. I don't remember the exact time. He was after. I think it was. He brought the subject up in the spring or summer of '75, and Hoffman and I simply told him that that was totally unacceptable. So I assumed that it had gone away. Now, I don't know when he may have signed that contract. It didn't come to my attention again. It may be that he's signed the contract prior to my departure from the Pentagon or just after. But in any event, he was doing it knowing that that was in violation of department rules and explicit instructions, and indeed quite in conflict with what he had professed to be ethical behavior over the earlier years. Before he came, I presume, in contact with the temptation of all that money.
Yeah, there's a very important subject to discuss that he ended up promoting his former clients like Northrop, apparently.
Yep.
There's a point of something that discusses him in passing and says that he promoted, ended up promoting his former clients like Northrop.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
And I have, what is,
I don't know. I think that really paid with good intentions. Yeah. Talks about Halleck and Halleck.
Yeah, it was for me a distressing thing because, first of all, I was the victim, ultimately the victim of deception. By somebody whom I had known personally, and also just the corruption of the man, what I now take to be the corruption of the man. Since this stuff came up, I very carefully avoided any further investigation into the matter. But,
you want to run out of tape somewhere?